When Jesus had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we have worked all night long but have caught nothing. Yet, if you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done this, they caught so many fish that their nets were beginning to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. In the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer. Amen. After being run out of his own hometown, Jesus is now in the early days of his ministry. He is calling the disciples. For Jesus knows that he can't get his job done alone. And to get them to come along, he first has to do a hard thing. He asks them to go right back out where they had come from, where they had fished all night long and caught nothing, and try once again. Simon said to him, "Master, we have worked all night long and have caught nothing." Then, with, I imagine, a cynical shake of his head, Simon Peter adds, "Yet, if you say so, I will let down the nets." Jesus didn't catch the fish. He asked the disciples to catch the fish. And when there were so many fish that the boats were about to sink, another boat was needed to carry the fish to shore, and more people had to get involved. Right at the beginning of his ministry, Jesus knew what we often forget. Ministry is more than one person. I was reminded of this fact on Friday. On Friday, I was called for jury duty. My summons number was 720. I figured I was safe. So I brought my bag of books and headed for the quiet room of the Mitchell Courthouse on St. Paul Street. Things were going pretty well until the first juror call. Numbers 001 to 520. Were asked to go across the street to the old post office building. Wow, I thought, 520 is not too far away from 720. But as the minutes counted down towards lunchtime, I began to think that Friday afternoon couldn't possibly be a time for new juries to be formed. At 12:15, I smiled to myself, "I think I'm home free." At 12:20, the voice over the PA system rang out, "Ladies and gentlemen, a judge is ready for you. Jurors number 640 to 740, please report to courtroom 225 in the old post office building." A band of not so happy and hungry prospective jurors trudged across the street in the spitting rain and snow mix. As we arrived in the courtroom, the judge was eager to seat the jury before lunch, so we had voir dire. "It will just take a few minutes," he promised. At 1:45, we were dismissed for lunch, and I was seated in juror seat number 4. My mind began to race. What about my appointments on Monday? The memorial service at the apartments? This judge had been clear that anything except open-heart surgery on Monday would allow me to be excused. As I settled back into juror seat number 4 at 2:45 on Friday afternoon, I finally had to put my other thoughts aside and listen to the case. The case involved an assault and theft, which involved a diamond ring being thrown into Druid Hill Park and a scuffle between two ex-lovers. There were only two witnesses. The chief prosecution witness was unable to be clear about what happened, and there was no other evidence. During the closing arguments, my eyes began to glaze over. At 5:15, the jury was given instruction and sent to the jury room to deliberate. If we could reach a unanimous verdict in 30 minutes, we wouldn't have to come back on Monday. It was clear that most of us thought there wasn't enough evidence to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, even though something had happened that night between two people that wasn't very nice. We thought we were agreed, and then one person said, "Well, I don't know. I think he did it. I think he should pay for what he did." We all looked at one another. A collective sigh went up in the jury room. And then the work began, the work of trying to bring the unconvinced along. And it was amazing what happened in the room. No one got angry. Everyone just took up the task of working to help this one individual come to the same decision, which we all felt was the right decision. Everyone was tired on this Friday afternoon and wanted to go home. But we all tried to work together to do our task and do it well. Our jury was from a cross-section of city residents, and we all worked together for the common good. By 5:45, we had delivered the verdict of not guilty, and we all felt justice was served. As I walked out of the courthouse on my way home in the sleet and snow, I smiled to myself. It was a community effort. It was ministry by more than one person, ministry for the common good. In her article, How Then Shall We Live? Suffering and Wonder in the New Commons, Sharon Dallows Park speaks about how we are called, especially in the wake of September 11th, 2001, to live in an enlarged, soul-sized world. Ministry for the common good seems to take in much more than we ever wanted it to do, or thought it possibly could. How do we live in a world that is increasingly complex and diverse? How do we leave the life of the early American common, where the schoolhouse, the doctor's house, the meeting house, the house of worship, the bank, the general store, the post office, the households and nearby farms were all situated around the village green? How do we take the world of comfort and security and apply it to a new template, the template of the global community? What is our village green today? What is our common? Whatever it might look like, it is clear that we are now being invited to become responsive and responsible citizens in the life of this new world, a place that is complex, diverse, and vast. And the main piece of this new commons is that we are required to encounter and transform our encounters with otherness in ways we have never been forced to before in our common life as Americans. But, of course, in our Christian faith, Jesus' ministry is all about encountering and transforming otherness. And the way that this works, this encounter with otherness, is a curious, delicious, and profound mix of suffering and wonder. Kind of like that first morning at the Sea of Galilee. Suffering and wonder. And it works in this way. This is from a story by author David James Duncan, who's a journalist also by trade, about the early war, or days before the war, in Iraq. Duncan says that when he wants to know what this expanded sense of suffering and wonder looks like, he relies on the physical senses, eyes, and heart of a woman named Jerry Haynes. Jerry is a nurse from Woodinville, Washington, and she heads a group called Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. She had been on three missions of mercy to Iraq before the war, and 10 months before the war started, she returned again. Before she went on this trip, amid all the flag waving and war rumbling of that time, Jerry's oldest daughter tried to persuade her to stay home. Jerry didn't describe her discussion to Duncan, but she did say that after finally accepting Jerry's sense of mission, Jerry's daughter offered her mother an old-souled piece of advice. "If you do go, Mom," she said, "be completely present wherever you go." When she did go, her daughter's words returned to Jerry in an Iraqi hospital bereft of medicine and hope. I can only imagine what that hospital is like now. While her group moved from bed to bed, Jerry approached a woman sitting next to her dying child. Jerry speaks no Arabic, and the woman spoke no English. Trying to be present anyway, Jerry looked at the child, then at the woman, and placed her right hand over her heart. The Iraqi woman immediately placed her own right hand over her own heart. Jerry's eyes and the mother's eyes simultaneously filled with tears. The hospital was crowded and Jerry's visitation time was short. She started to move on to the next bed, but then remembered her daughter's words, completely present. She and the mother were already crying, their hands over their hearts. There was nothing Jerry could do despite all her medical training. The child would die. How much more present, she wondered, is it possible to be? So she stepped forward anyway, with no plan but vague allegiance to the commandment, completely present. The nurse, without medicine, stepped towards the bed of the dying child and inconsolable mother, and she then put both of her hands out, palms up. And the Iraqi mother fell into her arms. If only this experience was unique, Jerry told Duncan, but I can't tell you any longer how many mothers I've now held in this same way. Her voice grew faint over the phone, and Duncan heard her whisper, I saw diseases that children would almost never die from in the U.S. Medicine so basic was not there. Then of this encounter, the hardened journalist Duncan said, then Jerry's voice faded over the phone, or maybe I just drowned it out. I've never taken interview notes while sobbing before. That is suffering and wonder meeting, and being completely present with one another in it. That is what ministry for the common good is about at its deepest, most healing level. But it's not easy, this suffering and wonder. Indeed, as Sharon Dallas Park says, a primary challenge in our spiritual formation in our time is that the critically needed grounding in reality is so easily sidestepped. There are so many temptations to bypass the suffering of others and escape the encounters that awaken us to wonder. So much in contemporary society distracts us, distances us, numbs us, and thereby cheats us out of the life-transforming encounters with both suffering and wonder that can enable the wise and shy soul to be formed in a larger citizenship, a deeper patriotism, and the greater faithfulness for which we have been created. There is so much here at Memorial Church, at so many times of our lives here, that is infused with suffering and wonder, infused with the love of God and Jesus Christ. As we come to another annual meeting together, I'm so grateful for the many times that I have met suffering and wonder here at Memorial Church. And I want to say two things about the year to come. Many of you have already asked me what you can do to help now that we are shorthanded on the staff. First, I want to let you know what you can expect from me. My priority has been and always shall be to be with you in the times of suffering and wonder as your pastor. Whether that means coming to the hospital or your home, a visit to my office, or even praying with you or taking action for situations in this city or the world. It is an incredible honor and privilege for me to be witness to the suffering and wonder in your life. And if you call on me, I want to be completely present in that suffering and wonder with you. So during the rest of this year, please let me know how I can do that. Because of the many tasks that will be before me during this interim time between assistants, I ask you please to call me or email me directly if you need me. I can't be there if I don't know. And the best way for me to know is to let me know directly. I also want you to know that one of my greatest sources of wonder and love and suffering sometimes in my life is my family, Brian, Jack, and Anna. This is Jack's last year of high school, and the last year of our family being together under one roof. Although there will be many things happening at Memorial Church, one of my priorities will be spending my personal time with Brian, Jack, and Anna. I may miss an evening meeting or come late so that I can see a basketball game or take Anna to a ballet lesson. I may not be available on Fridays or Saturdays for social functions, And this has generally been the case, but you may notice it more because there is not another clergy person to cover for me. Please be understanding. But I do have good news in the interim. Christina Paglianowin, who is a postulante for Holy Orders and will be attending seminary in this fall, God willing, will be our lay associate starting today through June. Christina, who will this month ratchet down her hours at Living Classrooms and be full-time by March, will be a strong support for our children and youth program, as well as a pastoral visitor, a preacher, a chalicist, and an office hand. This week, she will start to have a voicemail box, and she is available to be with you in your times of suffering and wonder as well. This month, I will begin interviewing seminarians to begin here sometime this summer. So, help is on the way. In the meantime, know that I love you and am doing my very best to be present in your life as your pastor in times of suffering and wonder and just everyday times. The second point, what can you do for the common good at Memorial? Be there as you always are, but especially now for each other to be present to the suffering and wonder in each other's lives. Take hold of the fishing net. At annual meeting, our revised ministries booklet, which you will receive, is chock full of ways to be present to one another and to those in our surrounding community and our world. As Frederick Buechner put it best, read through the booklet and then see where your greatest passion meets the world's needs, and then go for it. If we all do that, the catch will be abundant beyond measure. Let's embrace the suffering and wonder of each other, of this fragile earth, our island home, together. Amen.